From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score. Killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
There's a lot to talk about this week, and so we will get to it very quickly. Alan Chartok, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio, is here. Barbara Lombardo, a longtime editor of the Saratogian and executive editor of The Record in Troy. Ira Fussfeld, publisher emeritus of the Daily Freeman in Kingston, New York, and Associated Publications. And I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union. Here we are. We are the projectiles, the projectors. This is The Media Project. And my goodness, the past week has had a lot to talk about. We have to make a start with the anonymous op-ed piece in the New York Times. An extraordinary thing. It's not that there hasn't been an anonymous op-ed before in the Times. There have been, but it's usually been people in foreign countries whose lives have been imperiled and that sort of thing. But here we have this extraordinary decision by the editors to allow an anonymous writer, a person senior in the Trump administration, to say, we in this position are staying in our jobs in order to save the republic. Was this a good decision by the New York Times?
I absolutely think it was a terrific decision by the New York Times. Whether you're a paper as huge and fantastic as the New York Times or as small hometown local paper as the Saratogian, there are...
Which you used to be the editor
and
of.
It was my privilege to be the editor of for many years. I think that the same criteria apply no matter what size newspaper they are. And I was thinking about this on the way here today and that there's really three and a half things to consider. And one is, what's the importance of what that person is trying to tell you? How important is it for you as the publisher to tell that news to the public? How important is it? Two, is there another way to get that information where you can have a source that's cited and have a name source? Is this the only way to tell it? And three is, what is the credibility of the source? And so the people who are doing the publishing need to know that, and they need to make a very careful assessment, because it's really the credibility of whoever's telling the story, their credibility is on the line.
And what's the half?
And the half, I would say, is motivation. That I wouldn't want to get distracted by the motivation of the person that wants to be anonymous, but I think it's worth just keeping in mind, where are they coming from? What are they getting out of it? Why are they doing it? But regardless of their motivation, those other three factors, I think, are what you have to weigh. And I think they made absolutely the right decision to let the public know that this is happening currently from the inside.
But they know one thing that we, the readers, do not know, and that is who the person is who wrote it. And so I'm willing to, as somebody who believes in the New York Times, believes in their ethics, and generally agrees with their decisions, I'm willing to accept that they printed this thing without a name on it because of the stature of the person in their mind and the importance of the message. That said, if we were just talking about this as a general exercise in a classroom, I would say it is doing a disservice to the readers to publish an anonymous op-ed, because it's important to know when you're reading somebody's opinion who that somebody is. So I'm giving a grudging tip of the hat to the New York Times, but as a general sense, I don't think this is a practice that I'd want to see done more often.
Now, I agree with both of you. You know, you are exactly right. The future of the republic is at stake here. There are many people who think that Trump is entered into the land of the mad people. And therefore, as I have said many times, when Hitler is reviewed, people say we could have done something if we had acted early enough. Now, I am sure that the New York Times negotiated with this person, tried to get them to put their name on the thing, and that they wouldn't do it. And I am quite sure that we're going to find out who it is. Sooner or later, just like we did with Joe Klein, who lied about it. Some people call him Lying Joe Klein as a result of that, about primary colors, you know, which he wrote. There are all kinds of programs out there right now in which can identify words like lodestar. They can do all of that. But I do think that the Times was right in this case. Rex, I know that you have heard me tell the story one too many times about how one's about
there's a whole list of those.
When I asked Mario Cuomo on the air one day about how he felt about his son being married, and he went on eloquently about it, and they put in the top of it, they said, well, you know, the interviewer asked him. Well, no, I asked him, and I had a name. But then they put an op-ed piece. This is where we're going here. They put an op-ed piece in the New York Times, a really incredible thing in which Mario was telling Matilda, his wife, that they were going to vote for Reagan, not Mondale, because the next time it would be our turn, in quotes. And they wrote at the bottom, it was anonymous. And at the bottom they said, this person is an academic who watches Albany politics. And without being too outrageous about it, there were very few of us at the time. I was on television every night doing it and the rest of it. And, of course, Cuomo came right back to me and said, they called him Jericho, you know, Jericho. So this is dangerous stuff. You can hurt people. And I think he was really angry at me. Mario was really angry at me when he saw that. It wasn't me, by the way.
I'd be very interested in knowing at what point did the New York Times agree? How did those negotiations go? What did they entail? Did the person say, I'm going to tell you something, but only if you let me publish this anonymously? How did that happen? Once you make an agreement to somebody that you will accept something anonymously, you're stuck with that. And this is a little bit different because the op-ed piece, you're either accepting or rejecting something that they've written. But if you're reading something that they've written and they only want you to see it on the condition of anonymity, once you read it, you know, then what do you do with it? Then you say, oh my gosh, Mr. or Ms. X, who's a high level whatever, look what they're saying about what's going on. And
did you ever do it at your newspaper?
I was trying to think of times where we have protected a source, and I can't remember.
Well, you did it many times in news stories,
yes,
of course.
Yes, exactly. in news stories and also in written pieces, but I don't remember it ever being used by a politician or somebody in politics.
And so
I remember it being used for victim of domestic violence, or there was a woman who had a consensual affair with a priest in town many years ago. We protected her identity. So,
but there's a difference between the anonymous source in a news story and an
op-ed
page.
And what is that? Why is that different?
The anonymous source and the name that is most frequently used these days is Deep Throat. When Deep Throat was an anonymous source for the Washington Post, he only pointed Woodward and Bernstein in the direction of the story, and then Woodward and Bernstein had to go out and get their sources to confirm what Deep Throat said. The op-ed with an anonymous writer is offering his or her opinion and is not a source necessarily for a story.
I would disagree because look at all the stories we're getting out of this, as a matter of fact. And whether it's an op-ed or a source within a story, you're still giving your platform to somebody based on faith.
So how much
you are, but I think it goes back to the point that you made originally, which is that you have confidence in the New York Times editors, that they wouldn't be doing this unless they had exercised due diligence to be sure this was the person who was purporting it to be, unless they had really thought and reasoned this through carefully. And I have the same confidence, but I don't think there's such a huge difference. What it points out to me is how much more easily we accede to the notion of unnamed sources in news stories, which you see all the time, especially with this administration.
When you say we, don't mean everybody.
Journalists. I think that's true. I think that
there is too much of it.
There is a lot of it. And in this administration, you know, you begin at the premise that Donald Trump has always been the greatest leaguer to the press of anybody. You know, when he was running his little real estate empire, I say little because he ran a little family office, basically, that had billions of dollars in debt. And that was his real estate empire that he now blows up to having been a titan of industry, which he was not. Notwithstanding that, when he ran that and his stock and trade was information about Donald Trump, he was his own PR guy. He would be the anonymous source pretending to be somebody else who would be delivering information to Page Six of the New York Post or to Cindy Adams, to Liz Smith. And so for him to now decry anonymous sources when that has been his way to get his name out there, which was the most important thing in the world to Donald Trump at that time and now, is, of course, the height of hypocrisy. But if for journalists, I don't know that there is so much of a difference. We don't do it either. We don't allow anonymous letters. But in a circumstance like this, I would have.
If it were the future of the Republic, you might have.
Exactly.
And you're not going to open the door for a letter like this out of the White House every week or whatever. It's
I guess you might
be less likely to do it if you knew the identity of the person as to be someone who was not a senior level administration and, by my definition, pretty high up.
Yeah, I think that must be. I think the Times wouldn't have done this if it weren't. You know, you could say 100 people are senior officials of the Trump administration. I think it has to be somebody very high up and probably somebody engaged in national security.
Yeah, but you don't know.
I have no idea.
But I agree with you because otherwise what was in it is really not all that new.
Okay. So,
nothing
well,
shocking.
We can talk about that all you want, but one of the reasons I want people identified, although I certainly agree with the panel that, you know, this is an important story and probably should have been done, is I want to know what the motive of the person who is doing this is. So in other words, if I know their name, I can have some sense of it. And I don't know their name.
Right.
That's a problem.
That's a good point. And that was Barbara's half point. You know, she says that everybody has a motive, though.
Right. It adds to their credibility or lack of credibility. And I'm thinking, if the person gave their name and then would have to step down from their position, am I, as a citizen of the United States, better off having that person and people of that same mind working from within than having that person no longer in the White House?
An interesting element of this is the timing of it. Of course, Jim Dow, the op-ed editor of the Times, who, by the way, is a former New York Times Albany correspondent, all good things come through Albany. Jim Dow, I believe, said that this came through before they were in negotiations to publish this, before the stuff came out about Bob Woodward's book. The book itself has not yet been released, but we've seen a lot about it. Bob Woodward's latest book talks about there's an unhinged liar, a fifth grade intellect, an aggrieved and abusive Shakespearean king raging in the Oval Office. So, of course, the president attacks Bob Woodward as being a non-credible Democratic journalist. Nobody's ever accused. Well, Woodward, of course, has an astonishing track record as an investigative reporter. But you have to think that these two things coming together are rather explosive. But they are irresistible stories for us to cover as well, right? And this is part of what gives Trump his power. As Alan observed long ago during the campaign, actually, Trump simply sucks up all the oxygen in the room. Even if he's getting negative coverage, it's coverage. And he's so much bigger than anything else in sight that it actually strengthens him.
And helpful to get to his base. See, these bad people, the deep state, they're doing this to us down here. And even when he says something really stupid about Jeff Sessions being, you know, a Southerner. Now, you would think, since the South is red state, right? That would be a dumb thing to say. Not so, because those people who come in out of their houses and say, where are all the other dumb Southerners?
That's another reason why it's important that we find out eventually who wrote this op-ed piece, because he can fall back, he meaning Trump, can fall back on the litany of standard complaints about the deep state and the failing New York Times making up stuff. But if it is somebody who is a national security chief, the vice president, you name the names that have been tossed around, even the base has got to be saying, well, wait a minute, maybe this throws everything else into a new light. Maybe everything that Trump has been saying has been false.
You think? You think that
I don't know, but I think it's a possibility.
Interesting.
I mean, you were talking about motivation. Let's, for the sake of argument, say it's Mike Pence. Well, people would say he's very brave. He's the vice president. This is what he did. Other people would say
he
wants to be president. Mm-hmm. So that would sort of color your opinion. If it's Dan Coats, a name that's been coming up, the national security director, well, I don't think people would feel he has the same personal career goals to motivate him to release this document.
That's a very good point, Ira. In fact, Coates has been courageous. We've seen him say some things that flew in the face of the president. But maybe with this president, he waits a while and he fires everybody who gives him a hard time. So maybe Coates knew he was on the way out, and maybe he wrote it, but maybe not.
And Dan Coats is a former U.S. senator held in high regard by the Republicans in the Senate.
So was Jeff Sessions.
Well, then, yeah.
That's true enough. By the way, your thoughts are welcome. Media@wamc.org is how we get mail here, and we're always happy to hear from you. You know, so much has happened since this last program, including the funeral for John McCain, which we may say stands in stark contrast to what we're talking about in terms of the White House, the character that was eulogized. McCain, of course, had orchestrated his last show. One of the points that's interesting, in an article in the Columbia Journalism Review, a writer named David Uberti makes the point that the press was eulogizing, in all of the coverage of McCain's funeral, eulogizing the status quo that gave us Donald Trump. He was seeing the coverage, which was rather adoring of John McCain, I think you'd have to say, as being symbolic of the media's failure to acknowledge the impulses, the currents that gave rise to Trumpism, and that maybe this was part of the tone deafness of the media, generally speaking, to make so much of this. Is that an unfair assessment? Is there any other way to cover the funeral, the death of John McCain, than the way that it was?
Well, you know, there was a lot going on here. There are many people who think that the unending eulogy for McCain, and uncritical in many ways, was in fact because Donald Trump was on the receiving end of this, and therefore there was a hidden agenda in the press coverage. But it is true that one of the great things about American journalism that is highly suspect is the fact that on the way out, when somebody dies, you don't kick them in the rear. It's not supposed to be good. So even if you look at the coverage of none other than Roy Cohn, who is one of the most despicable people in the history of this country, you know, it wasn't that nobody ever brought up that he did this or that, but it was certainly not commensurate with the bad things this guy had done in his life, ranging from Joe McCarthy on.
That's a balance that newspapers do struggle with. When somebody of stature dies, enough to have an obituary published in their local paper, in the New York Times, and you know that the person had negative things about them that ought to be reported, and you have to decide, is now the time to bring those up, or do you, you know, give them a pass for their obituary type story?
Yeah, I mean, how do you write an obit about Richard Nixon without having Watergate in the first paragraph?
Right, I
never did that as an editor. We never have tolerated that. No, we don't pull punches in obituaries. We write stories about lives as they are, notwithstanding the fact that somebody's dead. That is the reality of life. If you want to do a pay on to someone, you can buy space in the death notices. That's advertising space. But our journalism is straightforward, even in a hometown newspaper.
So there was a lot of fawning over McCain.
There was.
But did he not deserve it?
He deserved.
He did some bad things.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yes.
The Keating Five, the this, the that. You know, I mean, there were.
Yes.
There were some bad things that he did. Bomb, bomb, bomb among them. And I got quite a bit of mail about that.
Mm-hmm. And here's in the David Uberti piece. I just want to the media element of this, he said their pageantry, that is, the way that the coverage went forward, gave off the aura of a more comfortable political world in which journalists are hands-off referees between politely warring factions. This alternate reality also provides the media class more daylight to absolve itself from sharing any guilt for harmful outcomes, like, say, the erosion of democratic institutions. So, you know, second-guessing, this is a writer who's not in charge. He's not an executive producer making decisions on the coverage of the day. That said, the 4 days or 5 days.
It was a long process.
But let me review. I hate to quote myself. You know how I hate to. But as I've said about other subjects, we tend, I don't know about we in this room, but many people tend to judge media and media coverage based on what they see on the cable news networks, whether it's point of view or volume. The cable news networks are perfect for something like this, where they can go wall to wall. It is a live event, and they're showing it for whatever happens, they're going to show it. The daily newspapers can also print more than they might ordinarily, depending on who the death is. But it's still only one page, maybe two pages if it's the New York Times, and you don't have to watch it. You don't have to read it. If it doesn't interest you, you turn the page. If you're turning on MSNBC to see Mika and Joe and they're doing McCain, that's disappointing to you because that's the only thing on MSNBC at that time. So I don't think it's outrageous, the coverage, if it's placed where it ought to be. By the way, the network newscasts also did more than they might have if somebody of lesser stature died, but it still didn't dominate those newscasts.
So here's an email that kind of goes to some of this point from a regular listener, Jeff, who says, of course, I don't agree with Trump's attacks on the media, but compared to decades ago, newspapers and TV news are terrible. For example, I live in Saratoga, and a person I know in the emergency services said three people died of drug ODs in 1 week, yet our local newspaper, the Saratogian, never covers those stories, which is a huge disservice to the community who needs to know how bad the drug epidemic truly is. Secondly, I showed some of my high school students the Today Show, where when Jane Pauley was hosting, that would have been 25, 30 years
longer
ago.
Longer than that, right?
Yeah. And then the current show, the students' reaction was dramatic, exclamation point. They hate the insincerity, pop culture, bubblegum style of the current Today Show, which is entertainment, not news. That is one of the reasons why when Trump attacks the news media, there are few defenders except the news media.
So it's so interesting about this obit business, because there are signals, like somebody died suddenly in his home, quite frequently means committed suicide. Sometimes it does, right?
Yes, there are signals, I believe.
Sometimes.
And Barbara's no longer the Saratogian, but I'm sure she could speak to that area. That letter could have been written about my former newspaper as well.
And mine.
And yours. If something like these three deaths occurred individually in a hospital or without police being involved with no sign of foul play, it's likely that that would never come to light in the newspaper unless the newspaper happened to get wind of this sort of thing and there's a trend and they decided to do a longer
story. So now they will get
story.
Wind of it. You're totally right, Ira. And so I just made a note of that so that I can call the reporter after this taping is done to let them know that, did you know that in the last week we got from a person here that three people have OD'd? That's news, and people don't understand how we get news.
Yeah, it doesn't just come by divine intervention. And I challenge this writer, who's apparently a high school teacher, to pay attention to the news, because you cannot be reading the newspapers or watching TV, even in this community, and not be aware of how much coverage the drug epidemic, the opioid crisis, has generated.
Right, but in a local paper, it's what does it mean to me? What's happening about it in my town?
Who in my neighborhood? But
right.
Still, haven't we all done that? I mean, we have done thousands and thousands of column inches on this. We have done no fewer than three major ongoing, we have an ongoing project right now called Prescription for Progress. This person is not paying attention if they don't know about the drug epidemic. I do not accept that we have not done adequate coverage of the opioid epidemic. We certainly
Well, they might be talking about their hometown paper.
Well,
but that said, the basic premise of this letter is that newspapers are not as newsy as they used to be.
Hey,
and that's
on.
Hard to argue.
Hey, come on, guys. I know we're almost out of time, but you sit here week after week and tell us how badly you feel about the fact that, you know, we don't have the same resources to cover all of these stories. So
to
some degree, this is. And the second part of that is Barbara Lombardo has a brilliant son who is doing such wonderful work for you, Rex, on the Times.
David Lombardo of our state capital bureau.
Yeah, but my point is, if you get an entrepreneurial reporter, some of this stuff happens. You find out about some of this stuff. And if you don't have an entrepreneurial reporter who says there's a story here, you don't get it.
Oh, by the way, how did he happen to become a reporter?
Did I ever tell you that David was an intern for the Legislative Gazette that Alan founded?
Oh!
And that got him hooked into journalism.
And he survived. He emerged on the other end.
Amazingly enough, it all comes back to one place. Here we are at Northeast Public Radio. Dr. Shartok, thank you for hosting us here in your lovely studio.
Isn't it lovely?
It's a grand place. Alan Shartok, Barbara Lombardo, Ira Fussfeld, and I'm Rex Smith, and we thank you for joining us this week on The Media Project.
Such interesting people. Like the richest girl who could not bake a cake. Ting-a-ling, ting-a-ling, ling-a-ling, ling. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. They used to work like hell just for romance. But finally, the movies notwithstanding, they all got tired of patches on their pants. They organized a union to get a living wage. They joined with other.
The Media Project is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Rex Smith is editor of the Times Union. Judy Patrick is the vice president for editorial development for the New York Press Association. Barbara Lombardo is a journalism professor at the University at Albany and former executive editor of the Saratogian and Troy Record. and Ira Fussfeld is the publisher emeritus of the Daily Freeman. You can listen to or podcast The Media Project anytime at WAMC.org or just download the WAMC app for your iPhone or Android at the Play Store today. Thanks for listening.
They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give free cheers for freedom of the press.